want to express our nation's deepest condolences and most heartfelt sympathies to the family of George Floyd. Terrible event, terrible, terrible thing that happened. I've asked that the Department of Justice expedite the federal investigation into his death and do it immediately, do it as quickly as absolutely possible. It's a local situation, but we're also making it into a federal situation, and it's a terrible thing. We all saw what we saw, and it's very hard to even conceive of anything other than what we did see. Should never happen, should never be allowed to happen, nothing like that. But we're determined that justice be served.
Hello and welcome. My name's Kieran White, and you're listening to Change on Mars, the podcast which takes a cold, hard look at the underbelly of the COVID-19 era protests within the United Kingdom and tries to get to the heart of what caused them and why these protests have a distinctly different flavour due to the pandemic.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home. Because the critical thing we must do to stop the disease spreading between households. That is why people will only be allowed to leave their home for the following very limited purposes. Shopping for basic necessities as infrequently as possible. One form of exercise a day, for example, a run, walk, or cycle, alone or with members of your household. Any medical need to provide care or to help a vulnerable person. And travelling to and from work, but only where this is absolutely necessary and cannot be done from home. That's all. If you don't follow the rules, the police will have the powers to enforce them, including through fines and dispersing gatherings.
While many of us have been locked away this past year due to the COVID-19 regulations, only those who sought refuge in a cave would have escaped the bombardment of media imagery of activists taking to the street for various causes. The two most prominent protests were those of Black Lives Matter, or BLM, and the various anti-lockdown groups. These will be the two that we will be speaking about throughout this podcast. Largely in part to the ubiquitous use of mobile phones, the world witnessed the murder of George Floyd in near real time, which provided the Black Lives Matter movement a platform from which they could pursue once again their controversial demands. Meanwhile, a more direct implication of the COVID-19 policy was that of the anti-lockdown protests, which were a motley crew of conspiracy theorists, human rights campaigners, and those with no other motivations other than opposing illogical political policy. These protests were largely censored by the media at large, despite many participants. The origins of these two groups differ dramatically, and it's important to briefly explain some of the underpinnings of the two. However, it's only BLM that truly has an ideology that predates the pandemic, as the anti-lockdown groups are better described as a reactionary collection of individuals rather than a unified body. Black Lives Matter is, as per the ADL's definition, an extremist movement which came about in response to the acquittal of George Zimmerman, a Hispanic man, who shot and killed Trayvon Martin, a black man, in self-defense after a violent physical altercation back in 2013. The hashtag Black Lives Matter, as you've probably seen online, would go on to become synonymous with any death in the black community seen as politically expedient for their abolitionist aims, and a general deconstruction of the liberal order. While supporters of BLM believe that it is a movement for social justice and are told that it is a continuation of the civil rights movement, it's important to note that this is not the traditional liberal social justice that has been the most effective in the past and defined by incrementalism, but instead the neo-Marxian critical social justice. It is clear to see why many individuals who wish to do the right thing when being presented with information claiming injustices are being committed quickly divorce their support when the radical agenda is publicly declared, such as breaking up the nuclear family and abolishing the police. Black Lives Matter have sprung up in pockets across the US in relation to specifically selected instances, and many of these have been coupled with riots and widespread property damage. One such example is the killing of Michael Brown back in 2014, which again was unfortunate, yet considering the evidence, it was accepted as a fully justifiable shooting by the police. The misinformation peddled by the media and activists in Ferguson, Missouri in the aftermath caused carnage and resulted in $57 million worth of damage for the taxpayer and gave rise to what is known as the Ferguson effect. It's important to point out that data compiled by the CDC lists homicide as a leading cause of death in both 1 to 19 and 20 to 44 age brackets, with 35.3% and 27.6% chance respectively. Bringing this back to the UK, data by the IPCC compiled over the past 5 years shows that of the 311 deaths in or following police custody, black deaths accounted for only 26. For apparent suicides following police custody, black deaths represented a mere 29 of the 870, while Asians represented 32. In terms of homicide, 99 of the 180 total in the UK between March 2018 and March 2020 were black on black. Fatal police shootings of a total of 43 in the past 5 years, which is dramatically different, of course, to the US, the black community represented just 8. The argument many campaigners make is that of disproportionality in comparison to percentage of population, which on the surface makes sense. However, this is another statistical ploy to serve a purely political goal. In the battle for pure equity, the complicated reasons such as culture, subcategories of ethnic groups and the family structure are ignored. This was highlighted in the UK government's 2021 Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities report. On their website, Black Lives Matter state that Black Lives Matter is an ideological and political intervention in a world where black lives are systematically and intentionally targeted for demise. It is an affirmation of black folks' humanity and contributions to this society and our resilience in the face of deadly oppression. Now, it's hard not to read that and not assume it's hyperbolic. However, to them it's not. Everyone knows that black lives are not targets for demise, nor do they face deadly oppression. The facts bear that out. It is important to point out, however, that in no way does this mean that racism no longer exists or that reforms aren't needed within the police. It's simply that the accusation of so-called systemic racism is only substantiated by arbitrary data, which shows unequal outcomes. This argument is flawed on many grounds, as unequal outcomes does not equate to racism. Instead, the picture is much more complicated, and those who are not driven by ideological motivations understand, just like the gender pay gap fallacy, that this has become a political argument rather than one based on any real evidence that cannot be dismissed by even the most basic reading of the whole picture. However, when you consider that BLM believes in the Marxian fallacy of an egalitarian society, then you can see why equity is the goal by any means necessary, and anything that stands in the way of such utopia, I'd argue dystopia, realization, it is therefore required to be torn down and built anew in the image of their ideological framework. When you combine critical race theory, so-called racism is the ultimate hurdle to overcome, and any system that allows for disproportionate outcomes are thus condemned as racist. You see, language has become much of the battleground we fight on in the culture war, with the far left assigning new meanings to widely used terms, such as problematic, folks, and even racist. As well as the adoption of replacement terms with the new meanings in subtle non-obvious ways, such as the replacement of equality to equity. Much of the discourse around issues of race and race relations can be best understood through the Foucauldian idea of discourse, in which truth is best described as provincial and is influenced by power. This rejects the liberal ideals of universalism and individualism. It makes more sense than how subtle tweaks a lexicon allows for those who believe in incremental change and the idea of colorblindness to be drawn to the illiberal critical social justice.
Just as I have a dream that my poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream.
In 1963, MLK Jr. gave his historic I Have a Dream speech, on which he preached the ideals of universalism and to see everyone equally. It strictly rejected the divisive tactics of identity politics and instead sought to reject one's racial identity as superior to their character. It is no surprise, then, to learn that critical race theorists reject the Civil Rights Act, and theorists Delgado and Stefinczyk explain that, unlike the traditional civil rights, which embraces incrementalism and step-by-step progress, critical race theory questions the very foundations of the liberal order, including equality theory, legal reasoning, enlightenment rationalism, and the neutral principles of constitutional law. It's easy now to see why there is such a strong correlation between those who research the literature and those who reject the racist theory that underpins much of what we see in BLM. Since the scenes witnessed over the summer of 2020, along with the public coming to realise that the movement were distinctly different to what they were led to believe, public support for the movement has been failing. We only have to look at the institutional capture taking place, arguably since the 60s, which academics, journalists, and those in public office have taken on the role of activists teaching the neo-racist critical race theory, or more accurately, critical race praxis, in which it's applied to pedagogy. And of course, with critical race theory, racism is always assumed to have taken place. The question is not if racism occurred, but how. We've seen the manifestation of this destructive pedagogy within the US and the UK, in which the fallacy of white privilege is taught, despite all the data showing that not only does this not exist in its simplistic way it's taught, but its teaching only further damages race relations. To surmise, the statement Black Lives Matter is of course heavily impossible for right-thinking people to deny, and in an exercise of an effective branding campaign, the movement has attracted supporters through their natural proclivity to make the world a better place. I was one of them before I found out again exactly what it stood for. It then pushes through a deeper ideological agenda, such as breaking up the nuclear family, abolishing the police and prisons, as well as taking down capitalism. BLM has a deep and complicated ideological heritage and links to both the Chinese Communist Party and domestic terrorists involved within their fundraising management. Using these ideological frameworks, such as Crenshaw's critical race theory, they have been able to weaponize identity politics and subvert language so that the average person adopts the duplicitous new speak much easier. The anti-lockdown protests are completely different and rather uninteresting, as they lack any historical precedent due to the nature of their grievances. However, in the interest of understanding this movement, it's key to see them as a collection of individuals, which by their very libertarian nature reject collectivism and each hold idiosyncratic grievances. Just like the London manifestation of Black Lives Matter protests, many of the participants are only active on the surface and are less so than some of the fundamentalists on the fringes of the or the organisation level. The interests of these individuals dovetail around the fighting of authoritarian suppression of civil liberties in what they suggest to be for public health reasons during the pandemic. However, just like any movement, there are conspiratorial factors which lead back to the age-old anti-Semitic discrimination, which proposes that Jews are behind the pandemic and the censorship. And some of the individuals are also sympathisers of the QAnon conspiracy theory. So what makes these different from everything that has gone before? Well, it's easy to see these movements as a continuation of the same argument, more so BLM than anti-lockdown, by virtue of the movement predating the pandemic. However, never have we seen such a global grip as we have with BLM, despite the narrative and issues being very American-centric. The anti-lockdown protest, while not taking a different form in itself, as prior to the pandemic it did not necessitate its existence, is instead more broadly a new incarnation of the overall liberty-centric movement we see represented as such protests as those for Julian Assange and other civil liberty protests. And what ways has COVID-19 created these differences? Well, the thing is, the main thesis here is that COVID-19 had a real causal effect in the manifestation of these protests, which I argue would not have been the case if many of the draconian policies around the pandemic had not been enforced. There are two main factors for this argument. One, sheltering at home, and the breakneck emergence of the digital supremacy, from the way we work remotely to the governmental monitoring our health as a result. The second is a more abstract, but is related to the geopolitical sphere and the information war with the Chinese Communist Party. The only focus for the public was that of keeping up to date with the latest governmental restrictions, seeing the most intimate aspects of our lives micromanaged by diktat. We were also encouraged to keep in touch through online methods with our loved ones, and many of our social activities morphed into the realm of augmented reality. When combined with the swath of unemployment and furlough, many had nothing else to occupy their time other than scour the web for the next viral sensation. That is, if an algorithm hadn't already served it up. While government intervention over the years and crony capitalism eroded the prospect of many of today's youth, it was natural that the ever-learning, ever-adapting algorithmic forces of the tech platforms would find a way of magnifying fringe agitators. If we look below the surface and focus on the social psychological aspect of these two groups, we can start to see various contributing factors which predict the likelihood that such action would manifest. Stecklerberg and Klansman point out that there are two main factors influencing the determination to participate in collective action. These are what they call instrumental motivations and ideological motivations. They explain that shared grievances and shared emotions are developed through shared identity. These grievances originate when interests and/or principles are believed to be threatened. The more people feel these are threatened, the greater the anger and stronger the determination to protest, as to both defend those interests and principles and express their anger. When you add group identification, it further reinforces this participation. The greater the identification, the greater the anger. They go on to say, instrumental motivations refer to participation as an instrument to improve the situation of the group. The perceived efficacy of those instruments play a key role in the motivational dynamics. Ideological motivations refer to participation in defense of principles and values that have been violated. Strong feelings of efficacy not only help instrumental motivation grow, but also intensify group-based anger and thus amplify the determination to participate in protest. The same holds for ideological motivations. Strong feelings of injustice strengthen ideological motivation and intensify group-based anger and thereby amplify the determination to participate. So there's a lot to digest there. However, when we apply this to the two groups we're looking at, and at the novel intensification of digital immersion and the proportion of our daily lives taken up consuming such content, I'd say it's fair to conclude that this holds true. If we also consider that movements such as Black Lives Matter are inherently grounded in identity politics and engage in race baiting, it's clear to see that group-based grievances are stronger where collectivism is embraced. This, however, is not to say that individualistic movements such as the anti-lockdown protest do not manifest a group-based grievance, but it's more of an agreed grievance between individuals rather than a collectivist grievance. BLM, therefore, would be best identified as relying on instrumental motivations and anti-lockdown protests being ideological motivations, which I know this may seem contradicting my earlier point, but it is wholly compatible with BLM being ideologically driven, yet using instrumental motivations, i.e. BLM used instrumental motivations by attempting to improve the situation of the group, with the goal and conditions of said improvements being defined by their ideological framework, whereas anti-lockdown protests utilise the ideological motivation as a defence of principles and values which they believe had been violated. However, the motivations of those violations to the individual first and the group second. We can also consider the ways in which each group leveraged the unique circumstances of the pandemic to appeal to many passive participants. In the case of BLM, the data from the US suggested that not only were between 76 to 85% of protesters in Atlanta, Los Angeles, Minneapolis, and New York white, but based on device data, 79% and 91% of participants were locals. While on its own, it does not seem too surprising when combined with the fact that between 66% and 69% of participants being in the 18 to 34 age bracket. This is overwhelmingly a movement fronted by young participants, which were disproportionately affected by redundancies and psychological damaging restrictions. These are also the same demographic that are predominantly digital natives, getting most of their news from Twitter via influencers and activists. We know that most of the statistics from Black Lives Matter are at best intentionally misleading, yet politically it has been embraced by companies, governments, and academia. With such a high proportion of young participants, it would be a fair conclusion that many of these are currently within higher education or college within the US context, which is a notorious left of centre bias. And if not, probably in contact and have friends that are. Academia has been embracing so-called anti-racist teaching from the radical agenda of decolonizing the curriculum, which has its roots in the Gramscian idea of the Long March from his prison notebooks, which was designed to remove liberalism and Enlightenment rationalism, as well as the indoctrination of students to the radical views of critical theory without any alternative viewpoints. We know that the logic and reason function in the human brain is not developed until around the mid-20s. So, as these narratives are normalised by the media and reinforced within their everyday life, it is clear to understand why there is an organic desire to support such movements. However, there is a strong geopolitical game involved and psychological warfare emanating from China, which through its military civil fusion policy, it uses apps popular with activists and younger demographics such as TikTok to push content aimed at agitating factions within the West, with misleading videos of police brutality against black people. It's no surprise that Chinese Communist Party has seen BLM as an effective tool to destabilise the US from within by linking via funding methods, as it did with the Black Panthers under Angela Davis. With the anti-lockdown protests, much of the mobilisation was conducted online via encrypted apps such as Telegram, as people were forced to retreat to these secure platforms after a concerted effort by media companies and coordination with the government to censor anything believed as quote-unquote misinformation. Much was caught up in the net of this ambiguous term, and much of what we now consider facts spoken by officials would have been removed only a few months prior. One of the main sources of shared grievances was in the way apps like Telegram allow for information to spread on its platform. Many of the groups were set up so that those who believed in several conspiracy theories about Bill Gates and others, which created a further disconnect from the more moderate members. The tricky issue here was much of the theories were based on elements of truth. However, it was the process of joining the data points that created the conspiracy theory. We see this with followers of QAnon, that there is varying levels of immersion resulting in either deeply entrenched beliefs or passive loose ones. Many conspiracy theories re-emerged as an answer to the current situation, such as the Great Replacement, Holocaust deniers, and even more spiritual theories dubbed the Great Awakening. Many of these anti-lockdown organising channels were cross-fertilised with these outside voices, sometimes dismissed, sometimes embraced. Many were passive consumers of the information of channels set up to advertise independent businesses that would not comply with their lockdown, and even prepper guide communities. There was an interesting anarcho-capitalistic sentiment which resulted in an effective mobilising mechanism as well as the support network. The other important question is what kind of person affiliates with either movement as it pertains to political attitudes? Or why does one type of person feel more in common with one group than the other? Much of the push from proponents of Black Lives Matter is it is a battle between racists and so-called anti-racists. Instead, all the data explains that it instead divided along political lines, which is further underlined by the fact that many black right-leaning individuals reject the BLM narrative. The correlation between political leanings with BLM is also explained by previous explanations of its Marxist origins. With the anti-lockdown protests, it is indeed similarly explained by the political argument, but is not as clear-cut as the left-right paradigm. The anti-lockdown protests were made up of individuals who could largely, but not completely, be best placed on the libertarian left and right spectrum. And despite other philosophical conflicts, the agreement on the ideals of freedom is a unifying force. There are two fascinating studies on this by clinical psychologist Jordan Peterson. In one study on the association of agreeableness with political ideology and moral values, he and his team explained that not only are political attitudes heritable, but are also influenced by basic personality traits. The study goes on to explain that one aspect of agreeableness, compassion, was associated with liberalism and egalitarianism, whereas the other, politeness, was associated with conservatism and traditionalism. It goes on to say, in addition, conservatism and moral traditionalism were positively associated with orderliness aspect of conscientiousness and negatively with openness intellect. Now, it's important to point out, of course, that the term liberal here does not mean liberal in the British sense, but rather the American use of the word, which is used to describe the left of centre. So what does this tell us about our two groups? Well, it correlates quite nicely with the supporters differing on political grounds rather than that of the so-called good versus bad. But it also gives support through the issues, actions, tactics each group take when you compare to the previous notion of group based grievances. And now with the correlation of the compassion being a personality trait of those on the left, similarly, we see, again, somewhat less pronounced, but with the anti-lockdown groups being driven by a collection of individual grievances, and that those loosely described on the right being associated with orderliness, which gives credence to the well-structured and organised movement behind them. So what do these two groups have in common? Because they do share some commonalities. Well, it may not be obvious to some, but there are clear contributing commonalities between both groups. One of these is the influence unemployment played, whether through furlough, redundancies, or lack of jobs for students graduating just prior to the pandemic. In fact, the TUC analysis from January to March 2020 showed that just two of the industries hit hardest were that of accommodation and the food industry, with 37% of their workforce under 25, and the arts, entertainment and recreation industry, of which represented by 25% of those under 25. While there is no data on the anti-lockdown protests, from my own observations and the media images, many of the members of the online groups and the protesters at large are at least predominantly, but not exclusively, older than those in the BLM groups, and many of them are small business owners. We can see that there is a clear trifecta that uniquely created by the pandemic that would not have happened without it. I point to the sudden loss of routine through unemployment implications, the artificial push towards digital alternatives to everyday experiences, and the psychological manipulation through algorithms, foreign nations, and scientists. In fact, another ethical covert psychological manipulation tactics have been deployed throughout the pandemic to create a heightened level of fear to ensure compliance. The SPIB, a behavioural science subgroup of SAGE, wrote a paper advising the UK government back in March 2020, in which they say a substantial number of people still do not feel sufficiently personally threatened. It could be that they are reassured by the low death rate in their demographic group, although levels of concerns may be rising. The perceived level of personal threat needs to be increased among those who are complacent, using hard-hitting emotional messaging. Another commonality that is for both BLM and the anti-lockdown groups are that they are deeply rooted in conspiracy theories. BLM, at its purest, believe that police target black people more because all police are racist, and the overarching conspiracy theory of systemic racism. Or as BLM states, black lives are systematically and intentionally targeted for demise. The anti-lockdown protests in their original purist form believe in a coordinated effort of the elites to usher in a new world order. Both BLM and anti-lockdown groups have factions of differing beliefs. However, in this sense, the anti-lockdown groups hold the most diverse range of opinions and are not defined by them owing to the fact that they are a collection of individuals. Whereas, owing to its ideological foundations in BLM, viewpoint diversity is not tolerated. However, it is represented by proponents, but only if they are passive or lack contextual understanding about the group, its beliefs and goals. The last question I believe is worth asking in light of the previous points is, why do people believe in conspiracy theories of either group? To understand that, we can look at the compensatory control theory. In short, it suggests that people prefer order and structure, and therefore when issues are complicated and overwhelming, it is easier to side with simplistic explanations. We can make this argument about the prevalence of religion and spiritual beliefs, which provide clear and structured answers to many of the problems we face. Therefore, in an ever more secular society, I argue that these conspiracy theories can be seen as a secular theology, wherein forms of conspiracies can be seen as different religions. In fact, in 2015, John McWhorter, professor of linguistics and American studies at Columbia, described anti-racism as America's new flawed religion.
Anti-racism, as currently configured, has gone a long way from what used to be considered intelligent and sincere civil rights activism. Today, it's a religion, and I don't mean that as a rhetorical feint. I mean that it actually is what any naive anthropologist would recognize as a faith in people, many of whom don't think of themselves as religious, but Galileo would recognize them quite easily. And so, for example, the idea that the responsible white person is supposed to attest to their white privilege and realize that it can never go away and feel eternally guilty about it, that's original sin right there. The idea that there is going to be a day when America comes to terms with race, or that there could be, what does that even mean? What is the meaning of the coming to terms? What would that consist of? Who would come to them? What would the terms be? At what date would this be? The only reason that anybody says that is because it corresponds to our conception of Judgment Day, and it's equally abstract. When we use the word problematic, especially since about 2008 or 9, what we're really saying is blasphemous. It's really the exact same term. Or the suspension of disbelief that is a characteristic of religious faith. There's an extent to which logic is considered no longer to apply. That's how we talk about racism. So suppose someone asked, why are we to focus on the occasional rogue cop who kills a black man when 9 times out of 10, that black man is in much more danger of being killed by another black man in his neighborhood? Gosh, that's not pretty, but like many things that aren't pretty, it's also true. If you ask about it, well, you know you're not supposed to. Eyes roll, and you're given an answer that doesn't really completely make sense, and there's an etiquette that you're supposed to stop there. It's rather like certain questions that you ask a priest very gently, but you know that if you don't get a real answer, then you're just supposed to move on. That we're used to with being devoutly religious, that is the way racism is treated these days. It's a religion.